We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we'll take up a topic that we have discussed before on the program, probably one of the more controversial domestic issues here in the United States to come up in the last decade or more, and that is immigration. And just to see how controversial it can be, you need look no further than the state of Arizona. Last year, Arizona passed the nation's most sweeping immigration reform law, known as SB 1070. This law required law enforcement officials to ask anyone they thought might be in the country illegally to show their immigration papers. It's proven highly controversial. It's been estimated that protests and boycotts may have cost the state of Arizona something between $7 million and $52 million. The federal government has challenged the law, arguing that regulation of immigration is a federal and not a state matter. At the same time, surveys have shown that a majority of Americans actually support this law. Surveys also show a majority feel that the federal government isn't doing enough to keep people from coming into the United States illegally. And in all of this conversation about immigration and how the law needs to respond to the issue of people who are here illegally, I think, though, we've really forgotten that we're talking about people here and their lives and families and moms and dads and children. And in this part of Focus, we'll be talking with a sociologist who spent a lot of time doing work on this very area, that is, the impact of immigration and immigration issues on families. Cecilia Menjivar is a professor in the School of Social and Family Dynamics, that's in the sociology department at Arizona State University. She's here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk. This is the annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. It's named after Dan Sanders, who was for a number of years the dean of the School of Social Work at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. This is open to anybody who would like to attend. That's this afternoon, this evening at 7:30 in the Campbell Alumni Center on South Lincoln in Urbana. So if you would like to go, anybody is welcome to attend. Here on the program, conversation is what we're all about, and if people want to join, they can do that very easily by calling us, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455 if it would be a long-distance call, and if you like, you can also send an email. That's will-talk, just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. I suppose my jumping off point here is, again, this idea that, you know, in all of this debate about law and legality, I think that we have lost sight of the fact that we are talking about families here, moms and dads and children. And I just don't think that there's very much attention focused on that particular issue and what this really means for families.
Right. It is families who are directly affected in their everyday lives. The law affects families who live in the United States, where they're mixed status families, where a particular family can have all its members belonging to different legal statuses. The children may be U.S. born. An older child may be undocumented. A parent may be in the process of legalizing themselves. Another parent may be U.S. citizen or permanent legal resident. So we have that this dynamic of mixed status families. And of course, the law is very present in their lives because it gives some members access to certain services, to higher education, but it denies other members the same rights and privileges and duties. So these families, of which there are more and more in the United States, are very much affected in their everyday lives by the law. We also have another instance where the law is present in their lives, and that is when families are separated through deportation, And in this case, deportations affect not only undocumented immigrants and undocumented families, but it also affects especially mixed status families, where the deportation of a parent or a grandparent may affect directly the rest of the family. But we also have the family separation through laws, the existing legal system that makes it very lengthy for families to be reunited. So we have families who spend 10, 15, 20 years living separated. And so we have those different modalities where the law impacts families in their everyday lives.
Yeah. I think that's an important point to make, is that for people who are here legally and who are trying to, whose hope it is that family members will also be able to come, that process is very long. It's very complicated. And one might assume that if somebody is here in the United States and they have a spouse or a child or a parent who's living in another country, you might think, well, it would be an easy matter for them to bring that family member to the United States. It's not.
It is not. And what's interesting there is that it is not, but it varies by country of origin, because each nationality has a certain number of visas allocated to that particular nationality, and that is set by Congress every year. So, for instance, it is much easier for someone from Western Europe, where the demand for those visas is not as high as it is, say, from Mexico, or the Philippines, or China. So for some nationalities, it is the process to bring in a family member is much shorter than it is for other nationalities. For instance, for someone who wants to petition for a sibling from Mexico, the waiting time right now is about 19 years. And for the Philippines, for instance, in the same case, for someone who's petitioning a sibling, the waiting time can be up to 21 years. So in different relationships have different waiting times. Spouses, children who are under 21, siblings, parents, and it also varies whether the petitioning member is a U.S.-born citizen or a permanent legal resident. So all those technicalities make it very complicated. But the end result is that the long waiting time for people to reunite through a relative in the United States, it's a main feature of how the law affects immigrant families today.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about this legislation, SB 1070, in Arizona. The long-term fate of this still, it seems to be unknown because of this federal challenge. When the federal government said to the state of Arizona, they said regulation of immigration is a federal matter. It's not a state matter. You don't have that kind of authority. So there's some sort of question about how that is resolved. And certainly, and I'm sure that people were there, there were other kinds of laws that had that applied to the issue of people being here, people here who were undocumented. Mm-hmm. But this particular law, I think that some people were concerned about it, had a level of concern that was greater than they had before. Why did people see, why was this so, did people see this being so problematic?
I think it's because it included portions that were are still deemed unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. For instance, the most controversial provision in this law is the requirement of police to require show of legal residence in the state. And so, and that has been put on hold. A federal judge, Judge Susan Bolton, has put it on hold indefinitely, because it is very difficult to just ask someone to show proof of identification, because it violates all sorts of rights. And how are the police going to know who to ask for documentation? And so the argument there is that if they don't engage in racial profiling, they're not going to be able to implement this law. this law is very closely tied with racial profiling. So, and that's the reason why, one of the reasons why it has been deemed unconstitutional and is on hold indefinitely.
Hmm. It seemed that I think that a lot of people also thought that one of the things that concerned them about this law was it wasn't just about something like access to government services. It was just the fact that you were here.
Right.
That was the thing.
Yes, in fact, that was the sort of like the fundamental point of this law, mm-hmm. is the criminalization of the presence of undocumented immigrants, and that was part of the of a law that was supposed to have passed at the federal level, which gave rise to the marches that we saw around the country in the spring of 2006. And it didn't pass at the federal level. It wasn't approved in Congress. Mm-hmm. So the state of Arizona took that portion to make it a law in the state. And that's actually the most the most controversial aspect of the law, that it criminalizes the presence of undocumented immigrants, regardless of access to social services, which it's already federal law that undocumented immigrants do not have access to federally sanctioned programs, only to emergency services. And it was already the law in Arizona as well. It was passed by voters in 2004, Proposition 200, very similar to Proposition 187 in California a decade earlier. So this is regardless of access to social services. This is only the presence of immigrants in the state, which other states are imitating now. Of course, this Arizona is not the only one. It was the first, but not the only one now.
Well, I think that's true. That a lot of regardless of the fact that it's still sort of up in the air, a lot of other state governments looked at what Arizona had done, and I suppose that it also was it's reflected in public opinion that a lot of other places people said yes, we think this is an issue, and this is a good way to get at it.
Right, and the reason for that, I think it's there are two reasons for that. Mm-hmm. One is states, no matter what they do. At the state level, with all the laws that have been passed or are being considered, the almost 1,500 propositions at the state level right now that have been passed or are being considered, they cannot do anything about the number of immigrants coming into the country because that is a federal responsibility. But what the states are trying to do with this series of laws that are being passed at the state level is to make, as the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania said, to make the lives of immigrants already in the country so difficult that they will self-deport. They will go, they will leave, they will go somewhere else, or they will go back. And so it's not to limit necessarily the number of people coming into the country, but to create conditions where they are going to leave on their own. Mm-hmm. And that's what states are trying to do. The other reason, I think, is that when SB 1070 passed, other states and other politicians in other states were watching this closely, and they saw the reaction of voters in Arizona, how much in favor there were. And so that has brought quite a bit of a positive reaction in terms of voters electing legislators who are likely to pass these kinds of legislation. Yeah.
Our guest members, perhaps I should reintroduce the guest for anyone who might have just joined us. We're talking in this hour with Cecilia Menjivar. She's professor in the School of Social and Family Dynamics that's within the sociology program at Arizona State University, and she's done a lot of work on immigration and that issue and how it affects families and family life, and that's what she's here to talk about on the campus. We'll be talking tonight. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and we also have an email, so if you'd like to be in the program that way, you can do that, write to will-talk@illinois.edu. No one knows precisely how many people here are in the United States illegally. That it has been estimated. But I think that also some estimates have been made that there's actually been something of a decline.
Yes.
In the numbers of people who are undocumented in the last couple of years, and that maybe that tracks with the economic downturn we've been experiencing in the country. But you also have to wonder what the effect of laws that may be designed to persuade people who are undocumented to leave, what the effect of that might have been. Is there any way to know?
It's very difficult to know. One, in the latest estimates of the undocumented population in the United States, there's been a decline. And analysis by state have shown a higher decline in Arizona. Arizona experienced a 14% decline in the undocumented population, in estimates of the undocumented population from, I believe it was 2008 to 2009 or 10. To 2009. So people wonder, is this the effect of the string of laws that culminated in SB 1070? Or could it be the recession? Arizona has been particularly hit by the recession, especially in the construction sector of the economy, where that employed quite a bit of immigrant labor. So it's very difficult to separate those effects because Arizona was particularly hit during the recession. But there's also the question whether whether the decline of the undocumented population might have had a negative effect on the economy itself, because fewer people patronize fewer businesses and spend less, pay less taxes, fewer taxes, because undocumented immigrants pay taxes as well and contribute sales taxes in all sorts of forms. So there's also that question that is very difficult to answer.
Mm-hmm. Now, see, we've talked about the fact that there we think that there's been an overall decline in the number of people who are undocumented here in the United States. But there's a particular issue in Arizona. But one wonders that if there's been a particular decline in Arizona, has that been because people who had been living there had returned to their country of origin, or did they go someplace else within the United States?
Right. And that is what the Pew Hispanic Center has a report about. It's very difficult to tell, but earlier, about a year ago, the Pew Hispanic Center said that there are few indications that people are actually returning to their home countries. That what's more likely happening is that people are just relocating to other states in the United States. However, there are indications that people are returning, not massively, but some people are returning either through deportation or voluntarily returning to some communities of origin in Mexico and in Central America.
Does your research touch on the motivations for people to come to the United States?
Yes. Actually, I did that earlier on. And my research has focused mostly on Central American immigrants from Guatemala, El Salvador, and lately Honduras. And it's a combination of factors. During the 80s, of course, the political conflicts in Guatemala and El Salvador propelled lots of people to leave. But it wasn't only that. It was also that those political conflicts impacted negatively the economies of those countries. So it was a combination of the direct political violence, but also the devastated economies that offer few economic opportunities for people. So a combination of those factors got people to start leaving massively. Through the years, the conflicts have ended, but migration has not stopped. Migration continues and people leave the countries mostly because the conflicts left the economies in very bad shape and with few opportunities, but also the post-conflict violence that has taken place, that has sort of enveloped that whole region, has contributed to more people leaving. From Mexico, it's been believed that the migration has been mostly economic. And that might still be the case, although there there is now violence throughout Mexico. So it could be another combination of those economic and political factors, plus family reunification. The longer people migrate, the more their networks with families and friends are going to mature, and so there will be more incentives to join family members.
Mm. You talked a little bit earlier about the economic impact on the state of Arizona of people who had been living there and working there leaving. And the thought that, in fact, if there has been an impact on the Arizona state economy, it might well be because this pool of labor, which is significant, has left. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, an awful lot of the conversation about illegal immigration focuses on the idea that people who are here illegally, they somehow cost us. And I think it doesn't perhaps take into account the fact that they are contributing labor, and as you say, there are everybody pays sales tax.
Yes,
you know. So it's has anybody really looked at that? The cost, done a sort of a cost benefit analysis of people who are here undocumented?
Yes, yes. In fact, several think tanks and institutes have usually regularly engaged in this cost benefits analysis, and most estimates note that through sales taxes, for instance, immigrants contribute to local economies. But there's a disconnect there too. Their contributions seem to be more notable at the federal level, because they very often they pay taxes at the federal level. At the state level, there seems to be a cost incurred because their children attend schools, they can use social services that are emergency-based social services. So some studies point to that, the contrast between their contributions at the federal level and their lesser contribution at the local level. Other studies point to a net lack of contribution, but that's a recurrent sort of analysis that think tanks engage in.
Mm. You know, I think it seems that in a lot of the discussion about this issue, when people have looked at the fact that there are this estimate that, you know, could be 11 million, 12 million more people, nobody really knows. Could be a lot more than that who are here, who are undocumented. And then when people talk about solutions, I think that there are some people who have argued that, you know, this is a fact. These people are here. They want to be here. They want to work. They contribute their labor. They're ought to be some way for us to make it possible for them, first of all, to be here legally, and then perhaps at some point we'll get them on the track to becoming American citizens. Mm-hmm. I think that then a counter argument to that is people say, well, that's fine. I can appreciate the fact that they might want to come here to make a better life for themselves and their families. But it seems that the point that they keep returning to is the fact that they broke the law in coming. And I wonder if this is something that you can talk about, how people feel, people who are undocumented who come to the United States, because obviously they think it's a good opportunity, better than where they were, how people think about the fact that they, technically, purely speaking, they broke the law in coming here illegally.
You know, what happens is that, and this is something that it's one of those effects of the law. Many people who are counted as undocumented, mm-hmm, are already in the process of applying for different forms of legal status, mm-hmm, but they cannot be counted as legal until they become legal. So during that long waiting period, they still belong to the undocumented population. There are people who are temporarily protected. The U.S. government extends temporary protection to people who have been victims of either political strife or natural disasters. So, for instance, Hondurans have been extended temporary protected status for 12 years. It's temporary. That's what's called a legal dead end. They are given a work permit and nothing else, but they can work in the United States legally. They are not counted in the legal population. They are, because they are not permanent legal residents. So that's just one of those factors that you take into account when making estimates of the undocumented population. But for instance, in the case of breaking the law, what's interesting there is that people who have been here for a long, long time, who came in the early 90s, for instance, and have been were extended a temporary protected status visa, and then that expired, and then they tried to apply for political asylum, and that might have been denied, or they apply through a family connection for a family reunification visa. It's they don't necessarily see themselves as criminals, because what they're trying different options, but there are no options for a lot of people to even apply. There are many, many, many people who are in undocumented population who are in these legal dead ends. There's not a chance for them to apply. If there was, I'm sure people would apply in droves. So there's that qualitative difference between someone who has broken the law in a criminal way and people who are trying to behave by the law, but can't, because there are no legal avenues for them to become permanent legal residents. Mm.
This, I don't know if this is a question you wouldn't have an answer for, but so much of the attention is and has been on people who come to the United States first, who come illegally. There are also a lot of people who come with some kind of temporary visa,
yes,
who end up overstaying. So
right,
that they come legally, but they exceed the parameters of their permission to be here, with the ultimate goal that they do indeed want to stay in the United States. How do those numbers compare?
That's very interesting, because we hear is about people who cross the border.
Yes.
But the visa overstayers, whether they come with a student visa, with a work-related visa, with any number of the other 30-plus different visas that the United States has, those visa overstayers account for as much as half of the undocumented population in the country. It varies by year, but it's about from 45 to a little over 50% of the undocumented population is made up of visa overstayers.
And why does that not get much attention?
And I think it's because if we start paying attention to that, then the attention shifts radically from the border and border security and all of that, which has a lot of political traction, to an internal issue of service. How fast are these visas being processed? Who is watching the people who come here legally and overstay their visas? Why is the immigration bureaucracy not keeping a closer eye on this temporary visa?
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour of our show about immigration, and we'll talk some more about the effect of immigration policy on families with our guest Cecilia Menjivar from Arizona State University. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieves zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're here weekday mornings, and we have 10 different subjects of conversation for you. In the second hour today, we'll be talking about the Congo and the long Congo War with Jason Stearns. He's the author of a new book, Dancing in the Glory of Monsters. Tomorrow morning in our 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the Freedom Riders and their role in the civil rights movement. Raymond Arsenault will be our guest. He's professor of Southern history at University of South Florida, St. Petersburg. We'll also talk with Thomas Armstrong. He's a civil rights activist, and he was a Freedom Rider. He's authored a book about his experiences. To give us also an opportunity to promote a documentary, a new documentary that will be airing on our television station, WILL-TV, about the Freedom Riders. Then also on Tuesday, we will look at the issue of organizing and collective bargaining for public employees, something that's been also a subject of some controversy lately. And we'll have two guests, both of them from the University of Illinois, Joel Kutcher-Kirschenfeld, who is Dean of the School of Labor and Employment Relations, and also Craig Olson, who is a professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations. You can look at the schedule for the entire week and also listen to some past programs you might have missed first time around by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of the program, our guest is Dr. Cecilia Menjivar. She's a professor. She's a sociologist and is professor in the School of Social and Family Dynamics. That program is part of the sociology department there at Arizona State University. She's on the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk. This is the 20th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. It takes place at 7:30 tonight at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on South Lincoln. That's on the Urbana side of the campus, and it's open to anybody who would like to attend. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, join this conversation, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I'd like to come back to this and perhaps have you talk some more about families. I think that I read somewhere that it's been estimated that something like close to, again, we're throwing around a lot of numbers, but something like close to 14 million people are living in families where one or both parents are undocumented. And as you said before, from family to family, the situation can be very different in terms of parents and who's documented, in terms of children. We could have some people who came here with a child, so that the child is undocumented, but they could have a little brother or sister who was born in the United States. They could be U.S. citizens because they're born in the United States. It gets very, very complicated. And what does that do to the family dynamic when you're having to worry about something like, for example, your mom or your dad being deported?
Right. And that is when immigration law affects U.S.-born citizens, when one or both parents are at risk of deportation, or a grandparent grandmothers often take care of their grandchildren. Mm-hmm. There was a case just yesterday, for instance, of a grandmother who is at risk of deportation, not because she's completely undocumented, but because her application for permanent legal residence has taken about 8 years to process, and she traveled back to her home country to attend a funeral, and because it was an emergency, and then she came back and now she's in the deportation process because she did not request a permit to travel, which mm-hmm. often takes a long time to process because that's the nature of the immigration bureaucracy. It was an emergency travel situation, and so she's in her 60s and she's at risk of deportation. We also have, of course, the case of parents who have to take precautions for themselves so that they are not deported and separated from the children, because they worry a lot about what will happen to the children if both of them are deported. And then there's also the situation of siblings having different life chances in the United States by virtue of their legal status. The U.S.-born child will have access to financial aid if they choose to go to college, for instance, but not the undocumented child whose plight has been very visible in the DREAM Act. The Dreamers, they call themselves, the undocumented children who have lived all their lives in the United States and suddenly face the reality that they cannot attend higher education, not because they cannot enroll, but because they cannot apply for any sort of financial aid. So you have within the same family people having different, very different opportunities and eventually life chances, and you see the siblings who are not born in the United States watch their siblings who are U.S. born having access to medical care in different ways than they do, who grow up in a very different tier socially.
Mm-hmm. Well, how that must place terrific stress and strain on families. If for example, you have a family that worries about, everybody can't jump in the car and go someplace,
right,
because they're worried if they might be stopped. If mom and dad are in the car, they could both be deported. So for that reason, dad goes someplace, mom goes someplace. They never can do that together.
Exactly. In fact, this evening I'm going to talk about a case of a couple whose strategy, and this is, my research looks at how the law affects people in their everyday lives. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in this case, this couple, they never ride in the same car together because they are so worried that they're both going to be stopped in what's going to happen to the children. So, for instance, they both work at night, cleaning offices at night, and she goes with a cousin in that car, and the husband goes with a neighbor. They all clean houses at night, and they go to the market, the same thing. They go ride in separate cars so that if one is stopped, at least there's the other one who's going to be left caring for the children. So this is how the law affects people. They have to strategize what to do when they go to the market, what to do when they go to work, how children get to school, who's going to drop off the children. Lately, for instance, parents are concerned about their children participating in after-school activities because they don't want the children to spend too much time in between school and home. So those are sort of everyday sort of routine things that parents have to think about. Mm-hmm. Every day, what bus routes to take. People are driving less and taking the bus and walking more so that they don't risk being stopped when face the risk of deportation.
Yeah. You talk about how the wheels of the immigration process, how slow they move and how long it can take for you to pursue the avenues to become legal and become a citizen. People who are in families like that, do they think that eventually that's going to get worked out, or is it just a matter that they really just have to go one day to the next?
A lot of it. You see, what happens is that they have to go from one day to the next, but at the same time, life goes on. They live in families where people decide to marry, to have children. Life goes on with these legal concerns in the background. So, for instance, there's another family I've been following for 12 years in Phoenix. they all have different legal statuses. But right now, the parents both have, they finally both became permanent legal residents, but not the children. The children are adult men. There is three men. They are at different stages in the process of applying. The mother petitioned for two of the men, of the boys, and another one married a U.S. citizen, so he applied through her. But they live with that constant. They have to carry their temporary permits. One situation that I have encountered is that people don't, even if they move from one house or one apartment to another, they don't report that move to the immigration officers because just the form for a change of address form can take a year or a year and a half to process. So instead of going through that because they don't know if they're going to be in the new apartment or in the new place longer than a year, they just leave the older address so that they don't have to deal with that.
We have some callers to bring into the conversation. Sure. We'll be here for about another 10 minutes with our guest, Cecilia Menjivar from Arizona State University. The numbers here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, if you'd like to be in on the conversation. Let us go to a couple of people here on the phone. Someone on a cell phone to start us, and that's line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm really glad to hear the talk. I wanted to share, I just had a student, I teach at Eastern Illinois University, and I taught basic public speaking course last semester, and I had a student who did this dynamite speech about the Arizona immigration law, proposed law, and she began by saying, I probably don't look like someone for whom that law would affect, however, I am. I'm half Mexican-American and half Irish-American. However, I look like my father, who's Irish, but my brother does not. My brother looks a lot like my mother, who's Mexican-American. And so if we, as a family, decided to go to Arizona to see the Grand Canyon and vacation there, my mother and my brother would be stopped and asked to prove citizenship, whereas my father and myself likely would not. It was an absolutely killer speech, and she did a really, really good job. So I, you're talking about the effect on families, and even, I mean, if that law had gone forth, that's the kind of thing that could happen. I mean, if it's a family where two people would be likely requested to show, whereas the other two people would not, and all in with family. So I heard you say that law is on hold now. Do you know what the status of that is? It seems to me that law violates both the Fourth Amendment search and seizure laws, but also isn't it the Sixth Amendment that has equal protection under the law? Wouldn't it also violate that amendment as well?
Yes, and that is precisely the portion of the law that has been placed on hold by a federal judge. Because it is, first, the most controversial aspect of the law, but it's also the portion of the law that violates more rights. So that's the portion that's been placed on hold indefinitely. This is the second hold that the federal judge has placed on this law. So right now it's an indefinite hold for now.
What does that mean? That it's on hold.
That is not not implemented. It's a portion of the law that has not been implemented. There are other portions of SB 1070 that have been implemented. For instance, it is still it is now against the law to transport in your car an undocumented immigrant. So that's part of the law right now. But the requirement, because it's not the police officers and law enforcement agents do not have a choice. They would have had to ask for proof of citizenship or of legal residence. Anyone they suspected of being in the country undocumented in a lawful encounter. So that's the person that's been that it's still on hold. So it's not implemented. It's not, they cannot implement that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Lynn. Let's go to Herrick. There's another caller on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm good acquaintance, or you might even call close friends, with several illegal immigrant families, a few of which actually fit your profile, a mother and a father that are here illegally, usually one or two kids that were born out of country, and then one child that's here legally, or maybe two or three. But anyhow, the families I know that are illegal like that, the problem is that they're in the habit of breaking the law. So they don't have a big deal about traveling together. You know, if they were real worried about the law, they would have came illegally. So they travel together. They tend to let the one family I know real well, they tend to let the two daughters drive who don't have driver's licenses because they're here illegally. And, of course, since they're here illegally, they don't have insurance. So basically what happens is kind of like you were hinting on the thing about filing the form when you move. Once you come here illegally, you tend to use that as the excuse to do lots of things illegally. And these seem like really good people. They're good church-going people. I go to church with them. They're likable people. But their regard for the law is totally minimal. And I kind of wonder if it was that way in their home countries or if that develops because they get here and then, you know, they have to deal with all these other things, and it kind of becomes an excuse to ignore the law about everything.
Yes, in that case, for instance, if they, because they cannot get a driver's license, but still they need to get around to go to work or to school, they often see it as
jobs, by the way. It's not like they're taking, you always hear the thing that they take jobs mm-hmm. that Americans wouldn't do. Mm-hmm. No, the two working adults in the family that I'm thinking of in particular, both have real good jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that can happen, of course. You know, we have a full range of cases and experiences. What happens is that when people cannot get a driver's license, but they still have to go to work and to school, they see it as having no other choice but to drive without a driver's license. And the same thing with insurance. So it sort of snowballs. Once people are given, they are put on the track to become to legalize, they start acquiring all these other forms of legality here, like driver's license.
Oh, yeah, but now, like what I see with this family, for instance, if they go, like say they go to a food pantry and there's rules there about, you know, how much each family gets, what they will do is they will split up and they will go in as separate individuals. And that way they can split it four ways and they can get four times what a family would be entitled to.
Mm-hmm.
And it applies to everything. They very seldom pay a parking meter. Speed limits are just mere suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just about anything that they can get away with breaking the law, they do. I mean, they don't rob banks because, you know, that's a pretty high-profile thing. But all the little minor laws that kind of allow society to flow along better, they've just pretty well got to the point where they figure it doesn't apply to them anymore. And it's not just this one family. Like I mm-hmm. said, I know this one family I'm thinking of is because I'm very close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I deal with a lot of people in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And you were kind of acting like, oh, gee, everybody's worried to put two people in one car. Well, I'll tell you what. I can point out to you churches, I can point out to you community gatherings where hundreds of illegal aliens mm-hmm. get together at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't
mm-hmm.
think they're too worried about that type of thing. It might happen once in a while, but I don't think it's the normal thing.
Okay, and then we also have the difference between Arizona, where there are traffic stops, where there are workplace raids regularly, where people have to be more alert and conscious about these things, and then other states. But also, we tend to also see these two factors that might explain what you've seen. One is that the people have to learn when they come to a country where there are many other laws that they might not be familiar with, or they don't know how to apply them to their lives. It's a process of learning. And very often people are not familiar with that, and they become familiar with that as they spend time here. Another situation is that these sort of what we might call minor infractions, although they might be minor, but they also happen among non-immigrant families. But we get to see them more when there is this large looming legal concern and legal aspect of undocumented families. That can be more noticeable there. But many other non-immigrant families don't respect the speed limits, for instance, or many other non-immigrant families who are poor may go to a food pantry and split the family to get a little bit more food. That's not a pattern among undocumented immigrants. It might happen among poor people who are trying to make ends meet.
I want to try to get real quick one more question here, an email question. Someone writes, does the existence of a large undocumented labor pool drive down wages? If so, doesn't that exploit these workers and punish citizens and others who are here legally? So while the U.S. wages are higher than the undocumented worker would earn in his country of origin, it still dooms these families to existing on what is hardly a living wage.
Right. And there are some sectors of the economy where wages don't remain low because of the immigrant labor they employ. However, the employers argue that if they pay their employers more, then there's a ripple effect that affects everybody, because then they would have to raise prices and pay of other employees, and so there would be a ripple effect that way. But there are some sectors in the economy where, yes, wages remain low because they employ low-paid labor.
Well, we're going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest for this hour, Cecilia Menivar, is professor in the School of Social and Family Dynamics. That's within the Sociology Department at Arizona State University. She's visiting the campus and will be giving a talk on Latino Immigrant Lives, Reflections for Reform. This is the 20th annual Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture on the campus, and it's taking place 7:30 this evening in the Alice Campbell Alumni Center on South Lincoln, and anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for being here.